after I met, came into the program, where it was about the same time we came in together. And I've really admired Grady over the years. I've admired his program. And when we thought about getting a male speaker, he's the first person that came to mind. So let me introduce Grady.
Thank you very much, Melanie. Terry, have I got this where you can hear it? Okay, can you all hear me? Nothing worse than coming to a banquet and having a speaker and not being able to hear them. Okay, I'm going to ask you to pray with me. And the prayer that I'm going to pray is the third step prayer from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a very important prayer in my life. And those of you who know it, please recite it along with me. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those. I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Amen. It's sobering and humbling to be here. I come with a grateful heart. I make a lot of Al-Anon in my life because it has led to a transformation in my life. Patsy just read the traditions, and right away, I'm going to break one of the traditions. I did not adapt easily to this program, folks. Okay, so I'm going to break one of the traditions. And that tradition is the one that talks about that we are a program of principles and not personalities. I very much value that principle, and I know why it's there. I also know that there are some very special people in this program to me. Probably the person from whom I have learned absolutely most about living this program is the woman whose illness brought me here. And I would like to introduce my beloved wife of soon to be 40 years, Dell. If you want to know how to live this program, you should follow her around. Another person that I want to remember is no longer with us. And she may have been the person who kept me here or got me back to my second meeting. And that's beloved Alberta, whom many of you remember and treasure. And she said to me, after I had stumbled into that first meeting, she said, "Darling, just keep coming back. Just keep coming back. You'll get better." And you know, Alberta, you were right. Then there's Frank D.F. Frank used to annoy me. Oh, did he annoy me? Okay. But you know what I learned from him? And that's the wisdom of our traditions, that we simply all must work in harmony to keep this program pure Al-Anon, because that's what we know works. Barbara M., who many of you know and who is now in our national office, a key person in my recovery, may have been the person who demonstrated for me a commitment that made it possible for me to know that this program really does work. I had been going to meetings for quite some time, and I knew I felt better when I went, but I wasn't quite sure I believed what I was hearing. Okay. And one night I was in a meeting, well, it was a huge meeting, used to meet over at the Episcopal Church over on Morning Glory. And we were all, I arrived at that meeting late, and I was in awful shape. I had just gotten some very distressing news about my son. And I stumbled into that meeting. It was very crowded, and I wound up sitting on the floor. And I had seen Barbara at lots of meetings before then. And all of a sudden the door opened and in came Barbara. And I knew immediately that she was in awful shape. And she was one of those people that had been talking at meetings before and always seemed to just have it so together. Okay. And she would talk about her serenity and so on and so forth. And I had always been a little bit suspect of people who talked about their serenity. I really had. And Barbara stumbled into that meeting, and as soon as there was a break in the conversation, she said to that room full of people, "I must have your help tonight, and I know it's here." And I knew at that moment, hey, if somebody who had been in Al-Anon as long as she had, and who had talked such a good game, would come back to the program when she was obviously in such distress, that there must be something here. So thank you, Barbara, all the way up to Virginia Beach. Okay. And then there was dear beloved Al P. I fired Al as my sponsor 3 times. And all he ever said was, "All right." That's all he ever said. Al lives in my head today. I carry around lots of Al-isms. My absolute favorite one was, and maybe the one upon which I most heavily rely, is he said, "Grady, when you feel like she needs to go to a meeting, you go to one. When you feel like she needs to pray, you pray. When you feel like she needs to read the book, you read the book. When you feel like she needs to call her sponsor, you call yours." Okay. Thank you, Al. Yes. I still live by that. I still live by that. Then there was dear Daisy L. Daisy, who was the longest living Al-Anon member I ever knew besides Gurley. And it's people like Daisy and people like Gurley who keep showing up who convince me that this program really does work. Tell you something about Gurley, too. She has a wonderful sense of humor. One of the first things I ever remember Gurley saying was, "If you've been living with an active alcoholic, you're not crazy, you hadn't been paying attention." I've got to get through this list in a minute. Then there was Edie. Edie, who looked across the room at me that night and said, Oh, I was moaning. And I said, "You know, it's so hard." And Edie looked across the room with me and with that bracing voice said, "Yes, Grady, you're right. It is hard. But it's possible." Thank you, Edie. And then there's my dear friend, D.L. Somewhere way back there years ago, after I had had to let Al go, really. I think D.L. asked me to be his sponsor. We're an extraordinary pair. We're nothing alike, those of you who know D.L. You know, it's incongruous that these two men could be such dear friends. Along the way, we sort of forgotten who asked who to be sponsor, and we kind of sponsor each other. And he has made a tremendous contribution to my recovery. Now, I've ended that list, but I'm not going to stop there with personalities. As you did the little countdown, I watched very closely, and I know who was there for me, and I want to thank each of you. I've already thanked Dell. I want to thank Ann. I want to thank AD and Marcia. I want to thank Jim and Edith. I want to thank Mignon and Debbie and Joan. Gwen, you moved. Where'd you go? And Gwen. Yeah. Yeah. Pebble. Joyce. Lynn. Geraldine. Dear Clara. Janet. Curly. Betty. Evie. My beloved Ruth, because you all were there for me when I came, or shortly thereafter, and really shared with me and walked with me on my journey of recovery. Thank you very much. Okay, through with the personalities, we'll get back to the principles. Okay. What follows, let me assure you, I can't tell you how to recover. In lots of ways, that's a lonely pathway. I can only tell you what I did. And so that's what I will share with you. I can only tell you what worked for me. This doesn't mean you have to do it my way. If you did, it probably wouldn't work. You might take a piece or two out of here that will make, you know, a contribution to your recovery program. That's the way we have to do it, folks. We have to take a piece from here, and a piece from there, and a piece from there, and a piece from this person and that person, and so on and so forth, and meld it together in a way that works for us. I do think that there is only one must, and that is that what we take, we really must at some point test it out and see if it fits with the 12 steps of recovery. And if it does, there is a promise in those steps, and that is the promise of recovery. And it's stated in terms of a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, which for me means an awakening of the spirit. That certainly has been my experience. Yeah. My spirit has awakened as a result of these steps, and it continues to awaken. I will share with you a little later an experience that happened to me just last week. One of those aha, you know. Now I see something that I have never seen before in this perspective. That's how this program works for me. I continue to have awakenings of the spirit and continue to discover things from this program and from the people in this program that make my life rich and joyful. Let me tell you a little bit about how I got here. I was born and grew up in a very, very tiny little town right up on the Texas-Louisiana line, actually 18 miles west of Shreveport. It's called Bethany today. When I was born there in 1937, it still had its old name, Lickskillet. And you can still tell today, you know, who the old-timers are, because that's how they refer to it. Lick Skillet. There's a wonderful story about how it's got its name, but I'll tell you that at another time. But that's where I was born. I look back and I think I really truly did grow up in the safety of very small town America. It was a safe place. There were only two alcoholics that, you know, from that time in my life. One was a man named Red, and he lived up on the State Line Road, and Red stayed drunk most of the time. And he mostly stayed drunk on Dr. Tischner's antiseptic, which he bought at the Alexander Company, which was a large general store there. Red was probably my first introduction to alcoholism, but that was a casual one as far as my personal life was concerned. The other early knowledge of alcoholism was the brother of a beloved aunt of mine. She was the wife of my blood uncle, but she and he played a terribly important part in my life. They really were my second set of parents. And her youngest brother, she had two brothers, as a matter of fact, and both of them were alcoholic. But the one who was most prominent in my life was her youngest brother, John Wooten. And I now see so clearly, I didn't see it then, how the family dynamics of alcoholism were played out in that family. In lots of ways, John Wooten controlled that family. John Wooten and his drinking controlled that family. Whenever they got together for family gatherings, there would be this whispering, "Is he sober?" Yeah. And when he would go on one of his binge drunks, you know, the whole family, you know, would stand around wringing their hands and so on and so forth for several days. And then finally the men in the family would organize and they'd go into the Sabine River bottom and they'd cover it and they'd finally find him, you know, zonked out with his head up on a log or something like that. Okay, I remember that very well. And I look back and I know I saw the anguish in that family. I think I saw then as a child, not knowing the power of the illness. But those were essentially the only ways that I think, looking back, that alcoholism touched my life as a young person. When I graduated from high school and went away to college, I didn't go very far away. I only went 18 miles away and attended Centenary College there in Shreveport. And that's where I met and where I fell in love with my wife of soon to be 41 years. We met, we married, we fell in love. And that really is the proper order when I think about it. Yeah, that's really how it happened. We met, we married, and we fell in love. And we set about to build a life together. We waited for my 20th birthday for us to be married. So if you've been adding up, I'm 60 and I'm gonna be 61 this summer. And we began to build a life together. From early on, alcohol was part of our lives. We were with the fraternity crowd and so on. And alcohol was back then in those organizations a prominent factor in fraternity and sorority life. Yeah, it looks like folks would learn. Doesn't it? But we don't. Yeah. I say to people all the time, people drink because it works. If it didn't work, they wouldn't drink. Okay. And it is associated with fun. And that was really mine, our introduction to alcohol, was around fun times. Lots of fun times, lots of celebrations. So we built a life, and things went well for us for a long, long, long time. I launched a successful career. We had two gorgeous children. It was wonderful for a long, long, long time. I really don't know when things began to change, actually. There is no marker event that says that there was a change from the good life to that 2 years of what I look back upon as horror. There was no clear marker event. All I can tell you is that in retrospect, along about the 23rd year of our marriage, things did begin to change. But it was slow and imperceptible at first. I only see it clearly in retrospect. I did not see its early development and progression. Because this is the way it went. Those of you who know Del know what a bright and vibrant person she is. And that was the woman I had married, that's the woman I had lived with for 23 years. You know, bright and vibrant and energetic and creative. She's an artist about so many things. But one of the ways in which she was clearly an artist, and it's important that you know this, that she was an absolute artist in the kitchen. Yeah, just an artist in the kitchen. But somewhere about our 23rd year, things began to change. And it was very, very slowly. And I'll collapse this and tell you that over the course of that 2 years, she changed from a bright and active and vibrant and creative person who was active in this community, who we were entertained, to a prisoner in the den of our home. She slowly, slowly dropped out. I don't know why I couldn't see what was happening, folks. I don't know why. And yet I do know why. The most prominent feature of the illness of alcoholism is the symptom of denial. And folks, as Al-Anons, we have that illness just as surely as our chemically addicted loved ones have it. And so we manifest every symptom that they do except getting drunk. And I think sometimes we get drunk. We get drunk on anger and resentment and that kind of thing. But I couldn't see it. And I now know it was my attempt to say to myself, this isn't happening. This isn't happening. This can't be happening to my life. This can't be happening to my wife. This can't be happening to my children. It's a part of that denial process over which we have no control. You know, we have to defend if we're going to survive in that kind of situation. So that's what happened for us. Over the course of that 2 years, I remember there were conversations when, yeah, at some level, I knew that she was in deep trouble with alcohol. At some level, I knew that we would sit around and talk about what a wonderful life and relationship we had. And I think we probably believed that. We probably did. One of the things that now I know made my denial so necessary was that a number of years before that, actually about 18 years before that, I had sat in a class in graduate school in psychopathology, and the guest lecturer one evening was the man who was head of the Louisiana Bureau, it was called then, of alcoholism. And I will never regret, I mean, I will never forget, I will always regret, I will never forget how he started his lecture that evening. He told us who he was, and he told us the agency that he represented. And he said, "Let me tell you something about alcoholism. And let me tell you something about alcoholics. We treat them externally and we treat them internally, and let's face it, we treat most of them eternally." I didn't know I had stored that. I also learned in the next lecture, or maybe it was the third one, about alcoholism, that back then, mental health experts pretty much looked upon alcoholism, if you were a real alcoholic, it was pretty much a dead end. You died or you got a wet brain. Because see, they really believed, fortunately they've changed, but they really believed back then that primary alcoholism was, you know, an organic process that led to death or insanity. And they were in part correct, you see. But they thought the other kind of alcoholism was, you know, reactive to some kind of emotional trauma. And if you could just dig out the emotional trauma and get the person to work through that, then they wouldn't drink anymore. And what I had heard the director of the State Bureau of Alcoholism say was talk about those people who were real alcoholics, and that they were treated eternally. So that had been stored somewhere. So I think I must have known, as I began to see the signs, the first signs of my beloved wife's imprisonment by the disease, that I had to say, because see, I checked it out. I knew she wasn't crazy. I knew she wasn't emotionally disturbed. Okay. She's emotionally one of the most healthy people I ever met. Okay. And I knew that. So I knew she didn't have the good kind of alcoholism. You know, I knew that. And as I watched this, I must have been terribly afraid that she had the bad kind. And see, I loved her very much. And I could not tolerate, even for an instant, the fantasy that she might die of this illness. So I shut it off. You know what I did? Here I was, a college professor, and I was going around buying movie magazines, reading about Elizabeth Taylor. Because Elizabeth Taylor drank, and she wasn't an alcoholic. I was thinking, you know, Dell's like that. She drinks, but she can't. She's not an alcoholic. Well, she's like Elizabeth Taylor. Okay. All a part of the craziness. all a part of the craziness. Another piece in my recovery was my ego. You know, ego ain't all bad, folks. It gets in some places we need to get. I arrived home one evening early, stepped into, and I had an important public engagement that night, of which Dell was part. And I arrived home early to sort of mentally prepare for that engagement. And I drove in our carport, got out of the car, and stepped in the den, and it was dark. And I heard a rustling over on the couch, and then my eyes sort of adapted to the darkness, and I saw her over there, and she was just arousing. She had been in deep, deep, deep sleep. And she spoke to me, and I knew she was drunk. I think somehow, at some level, I had known that for some time she drank during the day. I had had one clear sign several months before. I was looking for my old Air Force boots, which I knew were somewhere in that big closet that we shared. You know, I hadn't worn my Air Force boots in years, but a man's got to keep some memories from the past, you know. So I was looking for my Air Force boots, my combat boots, and I was digging around in that closet. And in that closet, I found 3/4 of a fifth of Evan Williams bourbon. Now, you know, we all know that the closet floor behind the shoes is not a place where one keeps their bourbon. And I remember having pulled it out and went marching, you know, to the kitchen and said, "Look what I found," and put it on the table. "What is this?" You know, knowing, you know, what it was, knowing what it meant, but afraid to know what it was and what it meant. So I put it on the table, "What's this?" And she said, "It's a bottle of Evan Williams." And I said, "What's it doing in the closet?" And she said, "I don't know." Let me tell you how crazy it gets, folks. You know what? I believed her. I did. I believed her. Okay. You know, I guess I thought to myself, that's a proper place to store Evan Williams. Okay. So, yeah. See, there were little pieces back before that should have told me something's deadly wrong besides that growing knot in my stomach. Okay. But I couldn't see it. I couldn't deal with it, because I didn't want her to die. But anyway, there she was. She was drunk. And so she said, "I guess I'd better get up and get ready," talking about the event that we were going to that evening. She said, "I guess I'd better get up and get ready so we can go." And I said, "No, you can't go. Not in the shape you're in." See, that's where my ego came in. See, she had never exposed her illness publicly. There were 3 people who knew about her illness. And that was me, and that was our son, and that was her and our daughter. Her closest friend, who lived across the street, would tell you if she were here today, she did not know. She did not know. Well, anyway, my ego said, "No, you can't go." And she said, "Yes, I am going." Folks, That's when my denial broke. I had lived with this woman for 23 years, and I knew her well. And I knew that the last thing in the world that she would do would be to do something that would embarrass either her or me. And she thought she was able to go. Then the crowning blow was, I told you about her being an artist in the kitchen. She says, oh, by the way, I have your dinner ready. And she went over to the oven and she pulled out a charred Morton's chicken pot pie. You know, that only reinforced to me that the illness had now taken over. So my denial broke, but I then had to face the scariest thing in my life. And that was the reality of that belief that was stored back there, that real alcoholics die, and that you treat them externally and internally. And that most of them you treat eternally. So, I really thought at that moment that my life as I knew it had come to an end. I was terrified. I also had heard that there was sort of a new movement, you know, in this country about alcoholism. I knew vaguely about AA. I also knew, that there was another new movement, and that was this treatment-centered movement, and so on and so forth. That, you know, it had sort of moved, the treatment of alcoholism had become a respectable medical practice. But that was vague. That was fuzzy. Okay. But I had one personal experience along those lines. And a successful one. A woman who was a colleague of mine at the university, a woman that was very important to me. I had watched her deteriorate as a result of her alcoholism. And I didn't know what I had done when I did it, but I had personally done a one-man intervention with her about 2 years before. I remember her coming to school one day drunk. I mean, she was so drunk she couldn't get down the hall, and she wore full braces and walked with canes, so she was rattling down the hall. When I encountered her, I realized that she was drunk. And I said, Evelyn, what are you doing here in this shape? And she says, I'm going to teach my class. And I said, no, you're not going to teach your class. And I said, you know, I've been watching you. You've got to do something about your alcoholism. And she said, well, I don't know what to do. And I said, well, I don't know what to do either, but let's go in your office and let's call the Council on Alcoholism. And I did, and, what's his name, Dr. Larry, some of you know him. No, not Dr. Larry Hebert. Dale, the woman that you rode to Alexandria with a couple of years ago, lives on Broadmoor. What's her name?
Pam.
not it. But anyway, it's not important what his name is. Okay. I gave Dell instructions before we came here. I said, don't you dare stand up and say, no, it wasn't that way. You know. So see, when I ask her this question, she tries to play very innocent. Okay. Anyway, I got Dr. Whomever on the phone. He was not a medical doctor. He was a retired chemist from out at Ethel, it was back in those days. Thank you. Thank you very much, Rick. Dr. Paul Carpenter, yes. Okay. And I got him on the phone. I told him kind of the situation. He says, well, can you get her down here about 10 o'clock and I'll talk to her and see what I can do. And so she reluctantly agreed. I took her home, threatened her with her life if she drank any more. I went back and taught her class and then went back and got her. And we started down Park Boulevard. And Evelyn says to me, I didn't realize that she'd been drinking from a bottle which she hid in the oven. Okay. But anyhow, we got there on Park Boulevard, and she says, I'm not going. I said, oh, yes, you are. And she said, stop this car. I'm not going. I said, oh, yes, you are. And she said, I'm going to jump out. I said, Evelyn, if you jump out of this car, I'm going to floorboard it and run over you. And I got her there, and they got her to FEA Bear Hospital on the West Bank. And 2 weeks later, I went down, and I was her family for her family week. Okay. And I got a wonderful education about alcoholism during Evelyn's family week. I got a very different kind of education than I had gotten some 20 years before. They talked in terms of this being a recoverable illness and all kinds of things. Okay. But see, that was before I was able to acknowledge what was going on in my own home. What I now realize is that that experience, that intervention with Evelyn, thank you, Evelyn. Evelyn's no longer with us either. And that story did not have a happy ending, I must say. Okay. But I do believe that despite her illness, she's in the hands of God today. She died of the illness. But anyway, I now look back and I know that that experience with Evelyn was a rehearsal for what I was going to have to do 2 years later with my beloved wife. Okay. Well, make a long story short, when my denial system did collapse because of a charred Morton's chicken pie, strange things happen in our recovery. We never know when or why or what going to get us along this road. Okay. I went on to that engagement that we had planned for that evening by myself, but had left with, I said to her as I left, I said, I don't know what you're going to do about your alcoholism. It's the first time that I'd ever labeled it. But I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to get out. And I'm going to take the kids because I'm not going to live this way. See, I was still believing, though, that other message, that it was a fatal illness and that was its ultimate course. That was the most difficult thing I had ever had to do up to that point in my life. But I knew I couldn't live that way. I knew that I could not stay there and watch her die. I left, and I left on a pad of paper three telephone numbers. I left the AA telephone number. I left Evelyn's telephone number, because Evelyn was sober at that time. Okay. And I left of Dell's doctor, who, interestingly, it turned out after we were into recovery, her doctor came into recovery for alcoholism. And, you know, I think she had two classic enablers, me and her doctor. Two classic enablers. Her doctor's been in recovery ever since then. And you know, I think is one of the very, very prominent contributors in the recovery community today. So when I got back that evening, all the lights were on in the house. And Dale, when I stepped in, Dale said to me, Evelyn's been here, and I talked to Jane. Jane is Dale's sister, who's 7 years younger than she, who 7 years before then had gotten sober and is still sober today. If I'm calculating right, then Jane now has 23 years of sobriety. But Dale, of course, had never communicated with her sister about her drinking problem. The only discussion that we ever had about Jane's alcoholism was in the years when Jane was such an active and colorful alcoholic. And she was active and colorful, folks. Okay. Yeah, she made loud noise with her alcoholism. Okay. But anyway, Dale told me, says, I've talked with, Evelyn's been here, and I have talked with Jane, and Jane has told me that she has found a bed for me at the treatment center over in Denton, Texas, and that I can check in on Friday. That was good news for me. It was not hopeful news for me, because, see, I still didn't believe about recovery, but I said, okay. So I put her on the plane to go to Dallas. I remember doing dumb things. You know, I made sure she had no cash with her, so she wouldn't buy any booze on the plane. Yeah, I did. I made sure she had no cash with her. Okay. Jane met her, took her to the treatment center. Then I had the awful task, of confronting our friends and our family. So I went back home and I got on the phone. I first telephoned my mother. My mother, my mother and father were just such wonderful people, and so they were such anchors in my life in many ways. My father was dead by then, but my mother was still living, and my mother lived all of her adult life with manic depressive illness. If any of you have seen the new book, The Daughter of the Prince of Sheba, in some ways, that book describes my mother. I want you to know, folks, that when my mother was crazy, she was very crazy. When she was high. When she was depressed, she was very depressed. So depressed that she would not eat. Many times she had to be hospitalized and, you know, fed through her veins because she would not eat. But when she was not depressed, or when she was not crazy, she was wonderful. But anyway, I went, put Dell on the plane, no money, went to the telephone and called my mother, and I said, Mother, I have something I have to tell you. And I told her, I said, I have just sent Dale over to Denton, Texas for treatment for alcoholism. And I'm going to have to take the kids and leave. My mother sort of, I heard her do what I just did. She says, don't move too fast. Wait and see. I've never followed many of my mother's instructions in my entire life, and I don't know why I did then, but somehow I trusted that. And then I called Dell's mother, who didn't believe it. I don't think
think she ever believed it.
She died not believing that the Dell was an alcoholic. And then I went across the street and I talked to Lillian. That was Dell's best friend. And I'll never forget what Lillian said to me. She said, "You've got to be crazy." Well, anyway. She was right. I then went to my workplace and I talked to two of my most trusted friends there, one of whom was a specialist in alcoholism. But I talked to the first one, and the first one was kind of like Lydia, said, "I don't believe you." Said, "We just played cards, you know, night before last. She's fine." You know. And then I went and talked to my other friend who was a specialist in alcoholism. And he said, "Yeah, there are alcoholics that follow that pattern. You know, they're not all falling off bar stools or in gutters and so on and so forth." And he says, "It's real possible for people to be real alcoholics and it stay hidden from for years. Real possible." And I'll never forget what he wound up saying. He said, "But if she's a real alcoholic, you'd better get out if you're going to have any life." Well, anyway, she went to treatment, she came back home. In the interim, we had gone over there for a family week, and I learned an awful lot about alcoholism in the new view. I heard a reinforcement of what I had heard at F.E.A. Bear Hospital, that it's a recoverable illness. And one of the days that I was there, there was a woman who was the big speaker there. That particular treatment center was one that went along the Hazelden model, and they really believed in A.A. You know, they really believed in AA. They had AA meetings, you know, there at the center every day. They sent all the patients out into the, you know, cotton fields and soybean fields of North Texas to AA meetings and so on and so forth. And this woman was there, and she was from Houston, and she was the speaker, and she was a gorgeous woman. I would judge then about 52 years old. Gorgeous woman. I remember that. Gorgeously coiffed red hair. And so on. And she stood up and she said, "I'm Louise and I'm an alcoholic." And then she proceeded to tell her story. And she told the story that I could believe, that made me know that yes, my wife, who had never fallen off a bar stool, who had never had an affair, who had never been publicly drunk, was really an alcoholic. But she also let me know that she could recover. Well, that's not necessarily, folks, a good thing for Al-Anons to know. Because I made up my mind then and there, she was going to recover. You know, and that I would do anything to get her recovered, including running naked down Florida Boulevard. I literally would do anything. Well, she came home. I was determined to get her recovered. And she had been home for 3 days. And one morning, I was lying on the couch watching the rerun of some game. And my 15-year-old son, 6'2", about 205 at that point, steps into the den and he starts crying. And he says, "Dad, I've got something to tell you." And I said, "Sure, what?" And he said, "I'm in deep trouble with drugs, and I have been for 3 years." You could have flipped me over with a feather. I didn't believe him. That good old denial again, folks? I didn't believe him. I had not seen the signs of any, you know, drug use with him. Yeah, he made good grades in school. He was clean. He, you know, If you told him to be home by 11 o'clock, you could set your watch and he was there at 10:59. Just none of the signs. In retrospect, and as a family, we all laugh now that that was simply a manifestation of our expression of this illness. Folks, we were good in hiding this illness. We were so good, we could hide it from each other. All the while, each of us dying, caring very much about each other, but each of us dying a very lonely death. Well, got him in treatment. That was rough. That was rough. I had to work two Al-Anon programs. I did. I had to work two Al-Anon programs. I had to work three Al-Anon programs. I had to work my program. I had to work four Al-Anon programs. I had to work my program for Dell, and I had to work, it's beginning to multiply, folks. I think I'm up to eight. I had to work my Al-Anon program for Dell and my Al-Anon program for Wyatt. And then somewhere in there, I had to try to work my Al-Anon program. Anyway, I was just full Al-Anon. And I was going to Al-Anon like crazy because I was going to get those folks well. I was going to get them well. And somehow I thought that y'all were going to slip up and tell me how. You just never did. You just kept saying, keep coming back. It'll get better. Keep coming back. It'll get better. And for a while, it seemed like that was all you ever said. Just keep coming back. It'll get better. And the only thing I knew was that I felt better when I was there than I did when I wasn't there. And then after a while, I felt better when I was there than I'd ever felt. That really happened for me. I say to people all the time that I started getting the benefits of this program quickly, because I think God knew he was going to have to deliver fast or he was going to lose me. Because I arrived, there were so many things in my head, folks, that made me a misfit with Al-Anon. So many things that made me a misfit with Al-Anon. My God had been my brain and my ability to think. And I'm a pretty good thinker. And you all sat up there and you said, keep coming back, it'll get better. One day at a time. Things like that. And then you would say the one that was the zinger for me. And that was, let go and let God. And I'd think, let go and let who? I look back on that experience and I think, what craziness it was. I was feeling better, and y'all were saying those dumb things to me, and I kept going back and hating you while I was there. But I kept going back. And real quickly, I began to get better. Dear beloved Al played a key role in that. I'd been going to Al-Anon for several weeks. And I mean, when I was going to Al-Anon, folks, I was going to Al-Anon. I was going three meetings a day. On a bad week, I got in 11 meetings. On a bad week. Okay. I'm here to tell you, I did that for 3 years. For 3 years, I went to 2 meetings a day, and sometimes 3, for 2 years. I had to save my family. And in the process, this program saved me. I finally got off them and got on to me. And Ruth's sitting there smiling knowingly. She doesn't know how many times she sat across the room from me with that same knowing smile. So, Grady, you're going to get better. She didn't say those words, but that's what her smile said. Just hang in there, kid. You'll get better. Okay. But anyway, back to Al. I was at a meeting one day, and I was just in awful distress. And it was one of those going around the room meetings, you know. And I was about two-thirds away around it. I was about to die. And it got to be my turn, and I spilled my guts. And this woman across the room says, "Well, honey, you just got to let go and let God." It flew all over me. I got them left. But see, in here, it really was true for me. Let go and let who? Because I told you where my God was. Okay. And I got up and left, and Al followed me out. And he said, "Hey, wait a minute." Actually, her words was, "You got to let go and let God, and you just got to have lots of faith," she had said. Yeah, that was it. "You got to have lots of faith. I mean, you got to have lots of faith." So Al followed me out. He said, "Hey, wait a minute." He said, "I don't agree with her. You haven't got to have lots of faith. You just got to have enough." And, I mean, I was ticked by that point. After around, I said, "Al, how do you have a little of something you haven't got nothing of?" And Al said, "You know, I don't know. But let me propose an experiment to you." Well, that appealed to me. You know, that appealed to the scientist in me. You know, we're always conducting experiments to prove things or disprove things, although science doesn't ever disprove anything. Nor does it ever, well, it's quite the opposite. Science never proves anything. It occasionally gets enough evidence that we think we've disproved certain things. Okay, but anyway, he knew enough about me at that moment that he knew that that model might capture me, and it did. I said, "Sure, I'll conduct an experiment. What do you want me to do?" And he said, "Well," he said, "I want you to, since you don't have any faith, I want you to start talking to people who claim they do and see what you find out." Well, that appealed to me. I took to that like a duck after corn. I now had something I could do positively. You know, it wasn't this generality anymore about let go and let God and, you know, keep it simple, which was so general to me, I didn't know what to do. I wanted specifics. And so he gave me the specific assignment to go find out what people who had faith claim they do. So I did. And I began to interview you. I'd get there early before a meeting, and I'd remember that you had said something about faith or God. And I'd go up to you, and I'd say, tell me about the God you know. Tell me about this faith you have. And so on and so forth. And I'd grab you after meetings, and I'd do the same kind of thing. And about 2 weeks later, I ran into Al, and he says, "How are you coming on the experiment?" And I said, "Well, I've gathered lots of evidence." And he says, "Well, tell me about it. What have you done?" I said, "Well, I found out that people who claim to have faith do 2 things. And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "They all talk about praying and meditating." And he said, "Oh, yeah." And he said, "Well, do you think you could do that?" And I said, "Well, very honestly, Al, I think I can do part of it. I think I can do the meditating part."
because about 5 years before, I had gone to one of these guru sessions where you sat around, you know, and you sat in the lotus position and you did alms, okay? And that was sort of soothing, okay? So I said, I think I can do the meditating part, but I can't do this praying part. And he says, how come? And I said, because I don't know how to pray. And he said, well, that's no problem. By then, Al had discovered that I love words. He said, that's no problem. There are plenty of good prayers in books and libraries. He said, go over to the library, spend the afternoon, get you some prayers, start praying and meditating. So I did. I went over to the LSU library, and I spent an afternoon, and I found me first three prayers. Interestingly, one of those was the prayer that we prayed at the start of this piece, it's the third step prayer out of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was one of them. And then my second prayer was one that is attributed to Queen Elizabeth I. And my third prayer came from some Episcopalian publication. Okay, but by the time I got home, I had those three prayers memorized. Memorizing things comes really quite easy for me. So I had those three prayers. Since then, I've added two prayers. Okay, but I had those prayers memorized, and I called Al up, and I said, Al, I've got three prayers, and I ran them by him, and he says, yeah, those sound good to me. He says, you like them? And I said, yeah, I like the words. And so he said, well, just pray them. And so I prayed the prayers, and he said, I do want to talk to you about this meditation business. He said, I don't think you have to sit around in your den in the lotus position and do alms. He said, why don't you try reading some of the Al-Anon books and thinking about some of the ideas in that. You can call that meditation. So I said, fine. Did that. So I started praying and I started meditating. That went on for several weeks. And all this time I had been going to this meeting on Wednesday night over at the Broadmoor Methodist Church. And there was this little blonde woman with a pointed nose who went to that meeting all the time. And that was always a go-around-the-room meeting. Frank ran that one. And it was a go-around-the-room meeting. And every time we got to the little blonde lady with the pointed nose, she said, well, God just sits right here on my shoulder. And anytime I need him, I just turn around and there he is. It would incense me. It would incense me. But anyway, Al said, great, keep praying, keep meditating. Also, Al was having to do some fast paddling, too, to keep me out of Dell's program. You know, all this while. Okay. But I did, because I was desperate, folks. I was desperate. And so I kept praying and I kept meditating. I will never forget. I finally decided that what I was going to do was that I was going to pray those prayers every waking hour until something happened for me. I will never forget. It was 7:21 in the morning of a Thursday morning, and I was wending my way to LSU, and I was right there where I-10 and I-12 used to come together. I don't know if it'll ever get together again, but anyway, where it used to come together. And I was saying the third step prayer. And all at once it hit me that something was different. They weren't just words anymore. And some power was hearing them. I have never felt so full in all my life. When I got to my office, I ran up the stairs and I went to the phone and I called Al. And Al wasn't there, but Libby was. And I don't know how much of my story Libby knew, but she knew enough. And she was another one of those people who said, "Darling." Okay. She said, "Darling, I think you've just found God." And so I continued to pray, and I continued to meditate. And folks, I got better. I got better fast. Somehow, I no longer felt responsible for my wife's and my son's recovery. And I felt perfectly comfortable to concentrate on my own. I was, let's see, that date was actually, I believe, June 13th. You know, from my March 29th entry into Al-Anon. But I'd had lots of meetings by then, and I'd had lots of conversations with Al. It was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. So then I started going to Al-Anon meetings for very different reasons. Now I was there for a very different reason. I wasn't there for their recovery. I really started being there for my recovery. And I continued to go at this pace that I had gone before. One time recently, just for fun, I stopped and calculated how many Al-Anon meetings I've been to. And it's somewhere in between 4,500 and 5,200 meetings in the 16 years I've been in the program. And I continued to go. And it was wonderful. 3 weeks later, I wish I could tell you, no, that was the end of the story. It's not. 3 weeks later, I waked up of a Saturday morning, and the minute I opened my eyes, I knew it was gone. My newly discovered God was gone. In contrast to that moment on June 13th, which was the moment in which I had felt most fulfilled in my life, that was replaced that morning with the gravest sense of desolation I have ever felt. See, you don't know about losing things until you've lost it. I have never felt so empty in all my life. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. Dell got up in a few minutes and I told her about it. And she listened. And she touched me. And she said, "I love you." In a little while I called Al. And Al listened. And he said, "Grady, you might try what worked before." See, he knew exactly how to handle me. So I did. I went on a desperate search for God again. See, I had some sense of what I was looking for this time. I had no sense the first time what I was looking for. But I had some sense of what I was looking for. And I knew the pathway I had trod. I started talking to you all again. about your faith and about your relationship with God and what you did when you lost him. And surprisingly, and it was kind of scary that many of you told me you'd never lost God. And that was scary to me. But some of you would admit that yes, you had, and that you had found God again. So that was reassuring. And I read the same books that I had read before. And, you know, when I get set my mind on a go, I'm determined. I'd get up every morning, and there would be those books. We had a couch that had a wide arm on it. And there would be those books, and I would read them. I'd been doing that for, oh, I don't know, you know, 2 weeks, 15 days or so. And I was beginning to get discouraged because the emptiness was growing. The isolation was growing. And I had about decided that that experience of fullness was some kind of crazy fantasy. And there I was one morning reading the books, and I was drinking a cup of coffee, and somehow in picking it up I jostled the cup and it spilled on the floor, and I started to get up to, you know, get a hand towel to clean up my mess, and my elbow hit the stack of books. And I reached over to pick them up, and there's a book that holds a very special place in my life. It's called Al-Anon's Forum Favorites. And I picked up that book, and it had fallen open face down. And when I picked it up, guess what the words were that I saw? He who searches for God has already found him. And so, once again, I had a God in my life. Now I wish I could tell you that that was the end of the story. It isn't. You know, I still lose God. I envy you people who are able to maintain a constant awareness of God. I've never done that. What I do know today is that there are times when I don't believe. What I also know is it's better for me when I do. I can go for relatively long periods independent of my God and live pretty well. I'm no longer satisfied to do that. So when I lose God, one of the things that I do is start the search again. And where do I look? I look where I have found God before. In this program. I find God in you. I find God in the literature. I find God in my prayers. I only pray one spontaneous prayer, or one spontaneous prayer today. I now have 7 prayers that I pray. 5 of them are prayers I have borrowed. Okay. I still pray the third step prayer. That's my primary prayer, folks. I still pray the prayer attributed to Queen Elizabeth I. And I still pray that prayer from that Episcopalian publication. I also pray the seven-step prayer today. And I pray a prayer that's tucked away. In fact, I discovered this morning it's so neatly tucked, I had to harness some friends here to help me find where it was. I know the prayer. I just couldn't find it in the book. And that's in our book, As We Understood. And Dear A.D., with Marcia's help, found it. It's on page 214. And I pray that prayer. And then I pray my one spontaneous prayer that has two words. And it says, reach God. Let me close with this. Yes, I have found God in this program. I went through all the business that I hear other people struggle with about, you know, how do I know when it's God's will, when it's not? You know, we all struggle with that. Sometimes I have a fairly clear vision on that for me. And that is that, you know, I may never know God's will. But my task is to earnestly search for it. And if I will do that, God delivers. I have had my big spiritual, I've had lots of spiritual awakenings in this program. 12th step was written for me. Do the steps and you'll have a spiritual awakening. I promise you, it's there. It's there as a promise. And I've had lots of spiritual awakenings in this program, but I've had some big ones. And one of the first big ones was the awakening, the true awakening to the knowledge that I am powerless over others. That was one of the big awakenings for me. Okay. And I do believe that today. The other big awakening for me was the discovery of a God power in my life. That was a big one for me. And I've had many spiritual awakenings along the way. I had one just last week as a result of a meeting that I attended. We were on the sixth step. You know, I really can't calculate how many six-step meetings I've been in. It's been lots. I've sat in lots of six-step meetings. And, you know, I sort of thought, well, you know, what else is new to learn about six-step? And I learned something new about the sixth step. And that is that all of this business about removal of character defects and so on and so forth, it's a partnership. It's about a partnership between me and God. God will do the removing. That's his, her, its responsibility in that partnership. That God will do the removing. What God will not do for me is do it on his own. I have to supply the willingness. That I must become absolutely willing. And then God can transform the worst in me into an asset. And God will. I had just never seen it in that relationship before. even though I had been to, you know, easily 100 six-step meetings. I had never seen it until then. Okay. Yeah. It's that wonderful thing that happens when you get people together who are searching toward a common purpose. There's something magic about the chemistry of what happens in those rooms that exceeds what any one of us could say. Which proves to me, you know, that when we hear those wonderful things, yeah, even though a person says them, the wisdom is a product of the power, collective power, in that group, including those who remain silent. Yes, I believe in this program because it has brought about a transformation in my life. As I look back over my life, I know that I've lived a charmed life, and I don't know why. I do not know why. You know, it certainly wasn't because all those years I believed and trusted God. I have lived a charmed life. I now see evidence in my life that God loved me all along. And finally, I got women. And a good life got better. My life is more charmed today than it's ever been. I wake up every morning. Well, Grady, most every morning. I wake up every morning, most every morning, looking forward to the joy that this day is going to bring. Sure, I encounter threatening things. I've encountered some pretty threatening ones. But they fade quickly. When I join you in the search for God, I thank you for being here. I thank you for being there for me when you were. And by George, as long as my mind works, and this program works for me, I intend to be here for you. Now I'm here to tell you that for 16 years and nearly 1 month, this program's worked for me. And I know it can work for you. Thank you.